Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
It's big love, pop art, and fun times from the Wilson World Studios in California, USA. It's Big Pop Fun. Here's Tom Wilson.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Tom Wilson. Welcome to the Big Pop Fun Podcast. I'm big, it's pop, and we have fun. Brought to you by, first of all, brought to you by the Nerdist Network, and thanks to Chris Hardwick and the Nerdist Network. They make, they're makers of fine jams and jellies for over 2 years. So, and also brought to you by BigPopFun.com, my website of my art. Support the arts, everybody. Buy art. Support your local artist. And by TomWilsonUSA.com, my website where I play and sing and talk. And just do things, go places, and I put on shows with a stick that makes my voice loud, and I talk into that, and I play some music, and people have fun so far. I've been doing that the shows thing longer than the Nerdists have been making jams and jellies. Let's just put it that way. In the late 1980s, the poet Robert Bly wrote a book. Robert Bly was an older man, white, big shock of white hair, and a button-down shirt and a vest. Guys, when they get older, I think all guys go with a vest. He had a vest that had a sort of native looking. It was rustic looking with native designs on it and everything. Not the vest that either Don Johnson or what's the guy, Boston Legal, William Shatner. I don't even go to Star Trek. I've never seen a Star Trek. You should know that about me, that I've never seen one. So, I mean, I know, of course, what Star Trek is. I know of the characters, you know, beam me up, Scotty, whatever, because it's within the culture. But I've just never seen one. But I know that William Shatner was in the show Star Trek. And I know that now he wears a vest a lot because older guys have the gut thing, so they go to the – hey, look, I'm about to go to the vest myself, so I'm not casting aspersions. I'm looking and I'm going, hey, vests are not bad. They keep the shirt tucked in a little bit, or in Don Johnson's case, you can hide the girdle. So – so Robert Bly wore a vest, but he wrote a book, a very, very popular – book called Iron John. It was a folk tale of prose and poems that spawned what was known and celebrated and derided and parodied, of course, as the men's movement. Robert Bly, I think, actually called it the mythopoetic men's movement, because we're all into our myths and our poetry, of course, because we're guys. So Robert Bly actually did a PBS special that I remember watching back then. It was lots of men in a circle, and it wasn't the thing that people make fun of. They didn't take their shirts off and put on loincloths or anything. But I'll tell you, they did have a drum. They beat on some kind of rusticky looking wooden tribal drum, and Robert Bly, the white haired poetic shaman, he spoke of the feather of the eagle and joining men together, and the dignity of the man and the pain of our break with the father, and guys would cry and hug each other and weep over the Reagan administration and stuff, because they were so in touch with themselves and, you know, PBS subscribers and everything. So it couldn't have been their fault. It had to be dad or a boogeyman. Well, so the men's movement, it marched on and it's brought us to this day. But back then, what better way in the late 80s to honor, celebrate the men's movement than to put a sitcom about it on the new Fox network? Yeah, Fox was a relatively new network. They had just come on. They had just come out. Hey, we're Fox. We'll pay actors half as much money, and we'll just throw some stuff up against the wall. And so much has changed since then. Anyway, they were doing a show called Iron Men. kind of take off on Iron Man and Iron John and that stuff. So I was cast as one of the Iron Men, believe it or not. I was an Iron Man back then. The other Iron Man was a popular comedian from San Francisco named Jake Johansson. Jake is a very talented comedian, and Jake and I became great friends while doing the show, which had problems, as most new pilots do, especially a Fox pilot. It wasn't really a pilot. It was a pilot presentation. A pilot presentation was the producers got this new idea. It used to be you did a pilot, and they filmed the whole show, and you made, you know, pretty good money for doing a pilot, and you signed a deal where if the show went, you would have to be in the show for the next 4 years, but you had agreed to do that, and you make a pilot, and everyone did pretty well and shot it. And then they came up with this idea of a pilot presentation. I don't even know what the difference is, except you make less than a tenth of what you made initially for a pilot. They go, it's a presentation. We're not really filming it. Well, the cameras will be there and stuff, but we're not really filming it to put it together. We're just having, yeah, we're just going to do it. And you still have to sign all the stuff and we'll still film and stuff, but it's a presentation. So we'll pay you almost nothing. And I remember actually being on the set of this thing, and one of the actors, one of the guest actors was like, well, they, you know, pilot presentation, what is this? Well, they can't do this. They're not going to get away with this. The actors union's going to be, and I'm wrong about just about everything. If you have a decision to make, ask me and do the opposite of whatever I say. But that night I remember saying, buddy, welcome to the future. They just came up with a way of saying, hey, we'll just pay them a tenth of the money. And everyone will still go, ah, darn it. Well, okay. So so we were doing this Iron Man. And yes, it had problems. And actors and actresses were fired. And this actress got fired. And lots of script pages got trashed. But it was directed by a wonderful director named Peter Bonners. Peter has been one of the leading television directors for decades. Now, you would know Peter if you've ever watched the Bob Newhart show, the original one, the Chicago psychologist one, not the Vermont bed and breakfast guy one, or the one, well, he probably did three after that, but none of those. It's the one where he was the psychologist. Peter Bonners played Jerry the dentist on that show. And Peter went on to become really one of the premier television directors in show business and has worked for, I don't know, 30 years at it. But Peter and Jake and I got along well, made it to the end all the way to the taping night of Iron Man. And as the week of rehearsals was going on, the talk was all positive. People, you're always listening because you're an actor, so you're listening to the backstage. Oh, this is looking good. It's looking good. But really? The studio execs are buzzing about this. Oh, I bet this gets picked up. And we're all just eager puppies. You really think so? Oh, yeah. Buckle your seatbelt, buddy. This is going places. Really? Oh, yeah. So, on the day of our taping, we were taping that night. Anyway, on that day, Barry Diller, who was the head of the Fox network, left. Oh, he didn't leave the lot. He left the network. He quit that day, and not one Fox executive showed up to our taping, to our presentation. Nobody. It was a ghost town. And but hope springs eternal. Because still, through the exhaustion and disappointment, you know, still makeup people and wardrobe people, office workers were coming up to us. I think it's really funny. It might get picked up. No, seriously, it might. And you're still trying, really? You think so? Well, thanks, guys. Well, that was a disappointing night, but it made me a lifelong friend of my great buddy, Jake Johansson, who's truly one of the great guys in show business. Jake is a tremendous comedian with, I think, maybe more Letterman appearances than just about anybody. I don't know how, maybe 50 times on Letterman or something. Just an amazing and prolific comedian. So look for him on TV or YouTube, or his website is jakethis.com, jakethis.com. But he's a dear friend, and it was a pleasure to sit and talk with my buddy, Jake.
It's Big Pop Pop.
This is exciting.
I'm excited too, and I have no idea what I'm doing with this. I hope the equipment works. I hope this works, Jake.
Me too. Well, that's the biggest fear always, is that you're going to do something really great and no one's going to see it.
I've done that so many times.
Me
so many
too.
Times.
As soon as my wife leaves the house, I usually do something fantastic.
Live shows with no one in the room, and you're thinking, if only someone were here.
I've got to quit rehearsing.
If only, because the rehearsal's better than the show. Man, if two people were here to see this. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome. So, you're having me. I'm at your house. Well, okay. Am I even at your house? I'm in an empty house.
I'm Jake Johansson, and you're Tom
Wilson. I'm Tom Wilson.
And we're at my house. But this is not even my house. This is kind of my guest house at my house. But it's soon to be available for rent for anyone.
But it's very nice. It's sort of a front. It's an old Santa Monica structure that's really nice.
Bungalow-ish. Yeah, it's nice in here. Although the guy was in the other day who was going to, you know, be the broker, you know, renter, helper person, because I don't want to do that. I don't want to. Yeah. I get enough of the public. I have a job where I meet the public. I don't want to meet people who are going to rent my house. I want him to meet them, and then I'll see them when they're having.
Or he could buy a ticket, and you could do a show for him.
Yeah, that's how. That's my preferred way.
As you're signing CDs, he could ask you about the house,
and we could take a picture together.
Sure.
I totally don't mind that.
No. Right,
but I don't want to. I don't want to hang out with, you know, him all the time.
Yeah, but so people come up and they'll rent it.
But he came over and, you know, it's kind of like, so it. I guess it would be like if someone came over and started telling you what was wrong with your wife or your children or something. You know, comes in and he's telling, we'll have to fix this, and this isn't really right, and this sink is too short, and it's like, well, you could just for washing your hands. But
Do you think is that a thing with guys, or is that a thing with comics? That you just have a thing where, well, this is my stuff, and if you don't like it, when I was selling a house, you know, you're selling a house, and all the people who are coming in while you're there, mm-hmm. saying, well, this closet's awfully small, and immediately you have to fight the urge to go, well, don't buy it, dude.
Yeah,
don't buy. You don't like the closet. Why don't you go? Why don't I have an iced tea and you just drive away from here?
And what do you want to put in there? Why is it too small? I mean, I don't know. But I don't want to argue with it. If you don't like it, yeah, don't buy it. Or don't wash your hands in it. Or, I mean, I also, as far as that goes, I spend a third of my life in a hotel room that someone else's picks the hotel that I'm staying at.
Right.
And oftentimes you just get the weird whatever leftover room in the hotel they always try and give the comedian. And so, hey, you're just going to be staying here for a week or a month or whatever. You just deal with it. You just bend over a little bit when you wash your hands.
Right. Because you have to figure out where you are in Des Moines or wherever. So, and then you're looking out the window. Is that a Carl's Jr.? A mile and a half down the road I might walk to?
Now that I have the iPhone, though, you can go on Yelp and you can find out. It's like being a Marine, you know, you can call in an airstrike, or you can ask the guy in the helicopter where's the lunch, and not the enemy, but where's the lunch? They won't tell you where the enemy is on the iPhone.
No,
they'll only tell you where lunch is. But it is handy because you can figure out, like, I can't see anything from the hotel, and that's so you think, well, today I'm just going to walk for a mile in this direction. But now with the iPhone, you can look and you can see, oh, there's a Chipotle that's, you know, 3/4 mile that direction, and then you walk there.
Because the hotel people are always wrong.
Because the
night before, you get there very late at night in order to wake up early the next morning for radio, mm-hmm. as you well know. And mm-hmm. then you ask the person, so is there anything to eat around here or whatever? Well, there's Bobby's Barbecue. And okay, that sounds good. Is that a walk? Oh, sure, it's a walk. The next day,
never walked there.
Right,
though. That's
you've done 5 radio interviews. You slept 3 hours, and you end up in the middle of some cornfield, sweating through all of your clothes. Going, I'm just trying to find Bobby's Barbecue. They said at the hotel I could walk here. No, it's not a walk.
You can't.
It's not a walk. Yeah. It's not a cab ride because cabs won't even come out to the hotel that they put you in.
Well, or there's no cab.
There's no
places. It's not like New York.
Most places,
New York, you go out and you're to the curb and there's cars driving by, cabs that will pick you up.
Yeah.
But most cities are, no, you have to call. If you go to San Francisco and you call a cab, it's faster if you would just take the bus. Because by the time the cab actually gets there, if it shows up, it's, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour. You could have.
Do you end up taking the bus in cities?
No,
I used to do that.
I have now because not this is a commercial now for the iPhone. On the iPhone, you can put in where you want to go. Like let's say you find the restaurant that you want on Yelp, and then you can say, okay, directions, and then it goes into the map thing. And then on directions, you can go walking or driving, you know, in your own car, and it'll direct you which streets are one way, or you can say mass transit. And it will tell you. I was in Seattle, and it told me, like, you walk a block and a half this way, you get on the number 8 bus, there's going to be one that shows up in 12 minutes. And then you get off at this stop and transfer to that, or if you don't have to transfer, whatever. But it tells you. It's unbelievable.
So for Chipotle locations and bus directions, you're willing to give up Apple knowing where you are all the time.
I just assume they know where I am all the time anyway.
And everything. So
as long as they don't tell any... I don't think anyone wants to assassinate me. Maybe I'm living in a dream world.
So, so if no assassinations and they don't say too many bad things about you, you're good.
They don't say anything bad about me that I'm aware of.
You did the party. You did the iPhone party, I remember.
Yeah, that was not...
Did you get a free iPhone?
No.
No, you didn't. What did you get?
I got a black T-shirt that says iPhone on the front of it. I mean...
You're a true believer, man.
The T-shirt is sort of awesome and terrible at the same time, because what is it? Really, I'm just going to walk around in a T-shirt that just says iPhone
advertises
on the front
the iPhone.
I would have rather had a shirt that just said Tool on the front of it, because that's what you feel like when you're walking
around.
But
you were a true believer before the party, and then Apple kind of, hey, you want to do our big iPhone thing, and you're thinking free iPhone. They always do it. Gift basket, whatever in the room,
I knew it wasn't gonna be
nice
a free
leather
iPhone.
Satchel fill, and an iPhone in it. And you did the show, but for which I'm sure you did. You
they
did
paid
very well.
Me plenty of. If I had to divide my salary into iPhones, it would have been.
It would have filled the satchel.
It would have been more than 10 iPhones easily.
So you're good.
Yeah,
and you're good with the shirt. Great.
Yes, it was good. Yeah. That was that.
But that's over now. But you came from the party, and you're an iPhone.
That was a
believer.
Long time ago. But I didn't have an iPhone at the iPhone. Well, that was the launch party. No one had one then. Just the people who worked at Apple. That was when the iPhone first came out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was like one of those 2.7 iPhone.
That was the first iPhone.
And you got a T-shirt?
And I got a T-shirt. It just says iPhone. It doesn't say first iPhone.
Wow.
Or iPhone 1. I suppose I could put a 1 on it.
I got a yachting bag once. I did a show for Hatteras Yachts, where they just had millionaires coming to this big party in South Carolina at one of those big hotels. Mm-hmm. And you figure, well, I'm not getting a yacht, but usually they will have some kind of goodie thing that they're giving everyone else. So, yeah, it was a big leather bag with kind of Hatteras Yachts on it and stuff, like a weekend bag.
It's kind of nice.
My kids use that bag all the time.
You've got enough kids. See, I've only got the one child, so by the time I get a couple of bags, it's like I don't need another.
But as I said, that's one child. That's not a child. It's a fancy pet. You're not a parent yet. You're a hobbyist.
That's what you think?
Yeah. I think you're a hobbyist. Well, I think you have a little – yeah, you have a nice interest going. For example, like making model boats.
I feel like the one person that I made is high quality. That's what I focused on.
You worked
quality.
Hard on it. I know that about you.
And so, yes, I there is only one offspring of me, and I've got a lot riding on it.
Sure.
You know, in terms of how she goes forward.
And is that the one? You've actually come out of the dugout and, like, you know, waved your batting helmet to the crowd, and
well,
that's
it? I haven't gone so far as to, you know, snip my hose. That's not right. But I'm just
impressed that you would snip your own hose, which is...
I wouldn't do that.
No. You have to hire out.
You want to have that professionally done.
Sure.
But I think... I don't think my wife can make another baby inside of her.
Or she wants to. That's okay.
And I don't think she wants to.
That's okay.
I mean, it's hard to say with ladies, because that can be a thing. Like, one day they want to have another kid, and the next day they don't. And sometimes it's already after you've just had the second kid, and then they decide, oh, I wish we hadn't done that.
Right, right.
Not usually. That doesn't usually happen. No, but I think we're done. My life plan doesn't involve more children. I kind of feel like this kid is going to grown up and move out of the house just before I die. And so I don't
really
think, well, if I'm lucky, I don't know how long I'm going to live. Nobody knows. But I mean,
you're healthy, man.
I'm healthy. I'm in good condition.
So your daughter's not
she's
just
seven.
Born. Yeah, she's seven.
So she's seven. Well, I mean, she.
I hope when she moves up by the 27. Was she, the time she's 27 or
so
something?
So 20 years, yeah. So
20 years? I think you're going to survive 20 years.
Yeah, you're right. I'm definitely going to make it 20 years. So, but you never know. Something could go wrong, even on a global scale. You know, it doesn't have to be a health thing. You could be hit by a bus or a, you know.
That's true.
Economic crisis or drought.
You're going to be around. Yeah. I have a feeling. But you came. You have a sister, right? Just a sister?
Yes.
Yeah. And I just like, can I talk about your dad for a second? Because we
yeah,
did that
I like
party
my dad.
Thing. I just love
you
your dad.
You came to my birthday. A
I came
years
to your birthday.
My parents were visiting.
Yeah. So we went out to dinner with you, with your mom and dad. And your mom is wonderful. And I love your mom. Very wonderful lady that anyone could imagine. A Norman Rockwellian mom. But your dad, I love your dad because your dad reminded me of my dad. And my dad passed away quite a long time ago, though. But your dad is like a physically large guy with a big voice. And you
like
definitely...
Because he's also kind of like you. I mean, he's a big guy. He likes to have a good time. Sometimes I describe my dad... Well, now it's not so good because I'm not describing you. But I describe my dad as sort of... He's like a really big dog that you just... He never got trained exactly right, so
he will go with me too.
He tries to jump up on people, and it's like, oh, I'm sorry. He chews
those
up.
He still thinks he's a puppy.
Yeah, I didn't know you had shoes in here. He chews them up.
But I mean, but he's a big guy with a big voice, and you definitely know that he's sitting at the table.
Yeah, and he can get now. He can get a little cranky or opinion. He can get cranky sometimes, and he's got opinions.
But isn't that okay? Do you think that's okay for a guy of a certain age who says to everyone, listen, I understand that open mind thing, but I'm just going to go with a couple things that I've decided on.
Well, I feel like he's one of those guys who doesn't really know his own strength. So sometimes he'll get an opinion and then he'll, you know, it's like if you had a dog that was like, rawr, 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 right in somebody's face. And then you had to say, nah, he don't worry. He's not really
scary. But don't
scary.
You find...
But he can be scary. But
yeah, only by nature of his size and voice. Because many other people are as convinced of their points as he is.
He doesn't mean to.
No,
mean
I'm defending the big loud guy, which is actually myself. But I mean, he's allowed to have his opinions. He's just big, so people go like, "Geez, whoa!" It's Simmer. What's your dad's first name?
Jake. Just big Jake, bigger than me, Jake.
Bigger than you, Jake. Well, look, yes, he did remind me of my dad, and I thought it was great. I like those guys.
I like my dad. I like my dad, but he can be a little bit of he can be a lot.
So
if you're a different kind of sensibility, sometimes he can be a little intimidating.
Right. But with the nature of, so your dad was always like that when you were a kid and everything.
Yes, and I just saw a friend of mine that I was in college with, and he was asking about my father cuz when I was in my 20s, I mean, he loved to meet my friends and, you know, buy drinks. He had money. He was buying drinks.
So your friends loved him, right?
They loved
him. Everybody loved Big Jake.
And he's loud and you can swear around him and he swears and, you know, he's good.
So do you think that there was an aspect of your dad? Because I feel, did that aspect of our dad that we tried to control in our lives actually help us and drive us to getting on stage? The guy who's willing to get up, grab a microphone, and say, you know, I think some things, and here's what they are.
Yeah, I don't know, though, that my dad would have ever been I don't know. Well, of course, yeah, something about our childhood, something goes wrong. Something has to go wrong in your life, kind of, not but that as the joke version of going wrong. So something happens that makes you want to and enjoy getting up in front of a bunch of people and telling them stuff, because most people, they're afraid of that. Like, not just afraid, it's like they'd rather be attacked by an animal than have to go on and talk to 200 people for an hour.
So,
but we like it.
Right. And did you like it early on? I mean, did you really think?
I had some stage fright, as anyone would, but yeah. I got over it because I'm just going to deal with this so that I can keep doing what I want to do.
So there's something was some crack in the plaster which led you to get in front of people and talk. and mm-hmm. a part of your dad was in there going, well, I have as much right to say something as this guy. Or you saw a show and you said, you know, you saw a show of a comedian or anybody talking. You think, well, that's it. He spent everybody's time to get up and say that. Well, hey, somebody give me a microphone. I'll say something.
I don't know if I felt like, is that how you felt? I was more of the, you know, because there's the guys who were watching comedians when they started out and felt like, I'm funnier than that guy. I don't know that I felt like that.
I never felt I'm funnier than that guy. No. I felt, well, I began way before that in really getting up in front of people in debate, because my dad was a lawyer, so I was sort of, I felt it was this inexorable pulling me into a track, not that he made or my mom made, but it was just sort of, I guess I don't have a huge skill set, or I'm not athletic, or I wasn't particularly good at anything. I like doing music, but I don't, you know, but being in Pennsylvania, well, that's, but you know, you don't just, whatever, pick up a guitar and start singing and make a living with that. So I guess I'll do that. So I started getting up in front of people doing literally the oral interpretation of prose.
So you're trying to practice to be in front of a court.
Right. Like more of an orator or something, or just someone who stands in front of people or question in debating team. I can question people and I can do that.
I love the idea of Tom Wilson, attorney at law.
I did too. I did too for a moment.
Now, would you mind if I, like the next time you're over or we meet one of my friends, yeah. if I introduce you as my attorney?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because just the idea that this could be my attorney.
Tom
guy.
Wilson, Esquire. You know, yeah. But that's, I guess, the way you thought in Philadelphia, I suppose.
Well, you didn't think. There weren't a lot of people walking around in Iowa either, or Wisconsin, right. where I lived when I was
you're
a kid.
Sort of thinking, well, which briefcase will I like? What mm-hmm. you know? What kind of ties will I wear when I'm on the train reading the newspaper, sitting next to the same guys as me and everything? And of course, very early on, you go, wait a minute, that's a bad idea,
right? Right. No, I wouldn't have been able to.
No,
I
by 10th grade,
I would have quit. I mean, I got off the. This is what everybody's doing. Bus when I was 21. But I would have gotten. I was getting off. I wasn't gonna stay on the. This is what everybody's doing. Bus forever. I wasn't gonna be the guy like, okay, I got a degree, I got a job with a corporation, and then I worked my way up the ladder, and now I'm a vice president, and then I retired, and I moved to Florida. I was never gonna be that guy forever. I was gonna get off. So I got off early at 21. I was like, I can't be on this bus with everybody else.
And whatever broken thing in me was the same. I mean, I was, you know, and I was the sick kid and I was out of school and all this pressure was on me. And I was trying to do that. That was only maybe ninth and 10th grade. That kind of I have to conform, but I don't feel like. And then by the end of 10th grade, I'm saying I'm eyeing the exit door because this is not working out.
And I don't say that in a way like, OK, everybody who did that, there's something poor them. I say, look, it was like I took myself out of the game. It was like, okay, we're all playing a sport, and I just like I can't be on the team. I don't want to be on this team. I can't play this game. I have to be the person who's doing the show. I can't be the person who's watching the show.
But I think you know many times I've heard from artists of many different kinds of disciplines. I mean, there's sort of an envy of those people that were able to pick up the tie in the newspaper and do that thing and get a check for money on Friday.
We're in a little tiny room in my guest house talking into a electronic box, trying to get people to listen to that and like us enough to come and buy a ticket to listen to us talk in a room where we're talking in a room by ourselves.
Yes.
With the ultimate goal of convincing people to come to a room where we're all together. That's our goal. And so it's not normal. It's not right. We shouldn't stop. No. This is what we do. Yeah. But I'm saying most people aren't coming home from their regular job thinking, I think you know what I've been thinking, honey? I'm going to get a little box and I'm going to talk in it. I'm going to put that on the internet and then people are going to listen to it. And then that way when I'm at work, it'll be easier for me because people will know me because they've heard all my thoughts and all, me talking to all my friends. Most people don't think like that.
Well, it's absolutely crazy, but it's wonderful.
So, yeah, I'm jealous of the people who don't have to talk into a little box and try and convince people to come. You know, I love my job and I love what I'm doing. I like talking into the little box here in my house. I like being friends with you. I like flying to Atlanta on Thursday to do my show in a tiny room full of people who are getting hammered. But there's also a part of me that's like, you know, my fantasy dream. Most people have the fantasy dream of like, I wish I was flying to Atlanta and then I could be in a bar and get drinks for free and meet new people and everybody would give me a round of applause when I'm done with work. But our fantasy sort of is like, I wish I got up at, you know, 7 in the morning and went to work at 8. And then when I came home at 5, I could do whatever I wanted to.
Right. That you could just forget everything.
Yeah. I don't have to think about it. I don't have to try and think about, like, what are ways that I can, you know, be better, more, whatever.
But there are many
constant hustle of it.
But that's the hustle of the freelance person, no matter what you are. Because both of us have people. We get together when we're in Los Angeles. We call each other and we get together for lunch because still there are a lot of comedians out there, but very few people have the experiences that we share, which is that you go into a town, you're met by a person you don't know, you're driven to a hotel. Of which you don't know where you are. You're looking as the car is getting near. Are we near our hotel? And you're kind of looking out the windows.
To things that you might be able to walk back to.
Exactly.
From, you know, like if the hotel is within a mile of here, I can come back to that
right.
Starbucks.
Yeah. So you just, whatever it is. Oh, there's a Starbucks. Okay, we've passed the 2 mile limit. We're out of the zone.
Resetting your clock. Yeah.
Yeah, you keep.
It's kind of like a reality show.
It is a reality show because people don't realize that stuff. And I'm not saying it's bad. It's good. We tricked everybody, I think. I certainly did. I think you did. From the time when you were a young guy going, you know, I think I'm just going to do a show.
It's
and
a
they'll
better
sell
job.
Tickets to it, and that's how I'm going to pay for groceries and stuff.
Yeah, it's a better job than I think a lot of people think. A lot of people think if you don't get to be, you know, Robin Williams, Dane Cook, whatever, if you're not that kind of Jon Stewart famous, then
it's a shame.
That's too bad.
Never worked out for you, did it?
But yeah, the dirty secret is it's a good job, even
walking a mile and a half to Starbucks.
Yeah, it's weird. It's slightly weird. I mean, and if I wasn't trying to support my wife and child, if it was just me, I'd be rich.
Me too. I have four, okay?
Yeah,
I have four.
Just sucking off you. But the thing is, someday when you're very old and you're broke, they're going to feel sorry for you.
I'm pretty old and broke now.
Yeah, well.
I'm getting very little sympathy, and I'm old and broke now.
If you think you're old and broke now, give it 20 years.
Wow.
Give it 20 years. Yeah.
It's going to get even worse.
I like to think the older you get, that's better. You know, you feel like you're racking up a good score.
Just in life.
Yeah, in life. I mean, the object, we're trying to live a long life. That whole idea of live fast, die young is, I think, ridiculous.
That's not good.
It's ridiculous once you get to be 40, then you kind of realize, okay, I don't want to do that now.
Do you have a fast living period? That first thing, and you're the 21-year-old guy, and you probably did you get good fast? Were you sort of did you struggle on stage for a while, or were you
kind of got it for a few years? But then I feel like it was pretty quick. You know, 4 or 5 years after I started, then I won the San Francisco Comedy Competition. I was headlining comedy clubs, and so I was. Of course, you know, I wanted to then have a TV show and be a movie star and all that other stuff. So, you know, kind of at the time appreciate like, boy, this is really awesome, you know. But now looking back on it, it was really awesome. So I didn't have that dark night of the soul struggly time. So I got to be – I could have lived fast. I bought a giant TV, but I still have it.
that's still a TV that I watch.
Yeah. You know, I made some money in show business. I bought a big TV and I kept it till now.
Right.
And so
that's a good purchase.
That's good. But you can't hook it up to anything because it only has old school.
But that's really, ultimately, that's the smartest thing though, isn't it?
What?
Being the guy where things are going well and you're enjoying performing, but you don't get stupid.
I didn't get super stupid. Yeah, I didn't get... I'm still allowed to have beer, I think, although I'm kind of on a drinking hiatus right now.
Uh-huh.
because I've sort of decided to, I was a little depressed, you know, and so yeah. I thought, well, maybe if you're feeling a little bit depressed, maybe you shouldn't drink a glass of depressant at
right,
night.
Right.
So
you found you were, so you know, say, after the, or after
yeah,
that second
just,
show
you know,
Friday,
like
you were
sad,
just having,
and then, yeah, yeah. you know, so I've just kind of laid off, stopped the drinks are for happy people.
Right. Okay.
That's how I look at
it. So when you're happy,
so when I'm happy
you're
going to
take
see,
the
yeah,
drink,
when I'm
the
happy
drinking
again,
light
I'll have
will be lit again.
Yeah, I'll turn the drinking light on, and then I'll have a couple of drinks, but I'm not going to. But I was never a crazy boozer man, and I feel like I did any kind of druggy, naughty stuff when I was in college. And then, because when I started comedy, it was kind of like, this is hard. I can't be smoking pot, or I'm not going to get messed up with.
But up in
Coke.
San Francisco, like I was in L.A., you must have been around it like to an amazing degree. That's the thing. Like I never did anything. I've never done. You know, I mean, I was so sick. I would say I never did drugs. I mean, I've done a lot of medicine that was prescribed by a doctor for asthma or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't a druggy guy. But I just never. But I think if I look back, it seemed like we were the minority. The guy's just going, wow, what a great way. What a great thing. I get to put on shows and work on the show and make the show better, and I get money for that, and that's great. That a lot of guys, a lot of guys that aren't even alive anymore, you know, they took it in a different way.
Well, they cooked themselves. I feel like what I was saying is I was slightly different than that, because when I was in college, when I was 19, 20, and then 21 just before I moved to San Francisco, the drinking age in Iowa was 19. So I was already drinking, and then, yeah. you know, people think the Midwest is some, it's behind in terms of fashion and pop culture maybe a little bit, or at least it was back in the 80s. But it was ahead of the, we had, you know.
The drinking they had down.
I was drinking and smoking pot, and somebody would get Coke, or you'd take some speed or drop acid. I mean, I did all that stuff when I was 19, 20, and I kind of felt like, okay, that was some craziness that I got into in the Midwest. And then when I moved out to California to do stand-up, and I saw kind of what at the time I thought were grown men, people who were 29,
right.
Getting up to that stuff, I thought, this is ridiculous. I know what that you just stay home if you do that stuff. I mean, it just pounds you down. I can't do that. I mean, I'm not going to go through life with that kind of carrying that load. And so I knew better than to get mixed up in it, because I'd already had enough experiences with that when I was younger in the Midwest. I kind of associated that with more of a aspirational kind of loser time than now. This is it. I'm in the city. I'm trying to make it. That's just going to hold me back. So I wasn't tempted, because I felt like I knew what that was about, and it wasn't for me.
Right, right. So when did you come out to L.A.? Because I want to talk about our wonderful experience in Iron Men.
I moved to L.A. in 1987.
So you'd went to San Francisco, and you were the toast of
manager,
the San Francisco comedy world.
Bud Friedman liked me. I was working for the improvs, and I moved out here. And
that San Francisco scene was so vibrant and active up there. And, I mean, somewhat insular, because I came up to do the Punchline or wherever, and it was very – I mean, guys were friendly. But it really was very – this is the San Francisco comedy scene, and
it was weird when there started to be a national comedy scene, because San Francisco was a local comedy scene, just like Boston and
right.
Seattle, and there were places where people from outside would come there, but not a lot, you know? And so San Francisco, one of the clubs, started bringing in national or outside headliners 2 weekends a month, just one of the clubs, and the other two clubs kind of didn't, and then,
yeah.
and then that kind of spread around town. But when it first started happening, it was like, oh, there's an L.A. guy coming up here, and nobody's heard of him. We got to go see what's up with that.
Yeah.
You know, because San Francisco was a good scene at that time. Anyway.
It was. But I was one of those guys who came mm-hmm. up, and I worked with Jeremy Kramer and Kevin
yeah.
Pollak and the big, you know, the royal assemblage of the San Francisco guys. And as I said, they were very nice, but it really was – you have a return ticket to L.A., right?
It was
okay.
its own thing.
You're yeah. going to be here two nights, and then you're leaving. Okay. No, I'm not saying it's great. I'm saying, you know, that's probably, yeah, that's mm-hmm. fine. That's fine with us. And then, so then I went back down. But you came, and you were celebrated. Everyone knew who you were. I hadn't met you. I knew of you. But then we both get cast into a pilot presentation.
I had already done a bad pilot before then.
Oh, you did?
I had already done a bad
here.
Pilot
What was that
then.
Called?
That was called Visitors and Fish.
I think, isn't the plaintive sigh reserved for after every pilot title?
Well,
you
they all,
I mean, we all could do it.
It all takes it out of you because, you know, people who don't know how show business works kind of don't. The way, what happens is you're going to do a TV show pilot. And, my phone, I forgot to turn it off.
That's all right.
So you're going to do a pilot for a TV show, and you have to make a deal. They say, okay, we want you to do the pilot for the TV show, and in case it gets put on the air, this is what we're paying you to do the pilot, and then this is how much you'll get per episode if the show goes, and this is how many episodes they're guaranteeing that they're going to do per year, and then the second year, this is how much raise you'll get, and then the third year, this is how much raise you get after that, and then in the fourth year, you'll renegotiate everything. So you can't help but sort of fantasize that this show is going to go, and it's not just that you're going to make the money, but you're going to make that money, you're going to get that raise, you're going to put all that in the bank, you're going to buy this better house, and you're going to be famous, and everybody's going to know who you are. And if you go out and do a comedy show, it's going to be in a theater. And it's going to be, you can't help but have that fantasy because you're talking on the phone about the piece of paper that everybody's going to sign that says that it's going to, this is what's going to happen.
Right.
And so there's not a lot of people who are saying, but on the other hand, maybe you just get the money for the pilot and no one will ever see what you did. And so there's always that ending. It's more often than not, it's like, well, we shot it and we decided not to put it on the air, or, you know, the network executive retired, or we hired someone else, or somebody got fired, and because of that your show is not going to go, and then you're crushed because you necessarily have to get your hopes up just to even have the conversation about, well, no, I don't feel like that's a good enough raise in the third season of a successful television show for me.
Right.
Yeah, so you get your hopes up.
Yeah, you always do. I did my first pilot that I was almost in. They were doing a TV version of Blue Thunder, which was this Roy Scheider movie about an attack helicopter that the police had
in the city. It's
listening in on people. Yeah. You know, eavesdropping conversations. It has heat-seeking missiles. It does everything, and it's run by the police.
It's great. It's a world that we want to live in.
Of course, yeah. Who wouldn't want to live in that? And it actually flies underneath the tops of the buildings, down streets and everything, and it just blows any car to smithereens, and it blew a lot of them to smithereens. So Gil Gerard, this physically large actor, was going to take the Roy Scheider role, and I'm auditioning for this and everything, and I was working the Comedy Store in L.A. at the time.
You're auditioning for the Roy Scheider role?
No, I'm the friend guy who does the equipment.
Are you
in the chopper with him? Jaffo was the name of the guy. Mm-hmm. So I keep auditioning and going back and forth, and all of the producers, this was Roy Huggins, and he was the executive producer of the Waltons and all these big shows, and he starts literally.
It's good because the Waltons would have been better with an attack helicopter also, I thought.
Good night, John boy. mama, my arm. But the guy is showing up at the Comedy Store to see my shows and calling me Jaffo. Okay, the executive producer, hey, nice show, Jaffo. See you on the set, that kind of stuff. And then, so everyone at the Comedy Store knew that the guy was coming. So everyone thinks, Tom's going to be a big TV star. And he's the same thing that you said. Oh, and he's got a big deal, and he's going to buy a new house, and we'll never see him again.
Well, that's the thing. It's not even just your fantasy. No. It's everybody else around you is participating in the fantasy birthday party of it. And
I was a kid, so I'm trying to kind of tamp it down a little bit because I know I'm still auditioning. But okay, that's funny, guys, but don't go crazy with it. But okay, all right, I guess it's good. So and then Gil Gerard didn't want to do it, and they hired James Farentino, and they just said, as has happened a lot of times with me, is you're just too big to fit in the helicopter with James Farentino. So actually Dana Carvey got the job as Jaffo in that Blue Thunder. But anyway, so I've got to go, and everyone's asking me, so, you know, whatever. So how's the shoot going on the Blue Thunder? It happened 1,000. I didn't get that. You didn't get it. Oh, they went, Dana Carvey. I mean, another comedian. Oh, man. So from that point, I never spoke about anything. But a ton of guys did that. I mean, Michael Keaton was like Mr. Pilot. I remember when he was doing stand-up at the Comedy Store. Michael was, I mean, he was in It seemed like he got three pilots every pilot season, but nothing would go.
Well, that thing that we did. So we do it. They say it's a pilot presentation,
which was one of the early ones, which was what Fox did, which was, yeah, it's a presentation. We're not even saying it's a pilot.
Because they don't want to pay you for your pilot fee. So it was like you just got paid like barely what you might make in a comedy club for that week.
Right. You'd make 10% maybe of what you'd make for making an actual pilot.
Yeah, or 5.
Yeah.
And then the idea was, okay, well, we're not going to tape it. The executives are just going to come watch it, and they'll decide if they want to make a pilot out of it afterwards, right, or if they want to make it a TV show. And that way they're not stuck with the pilot with its flaws. Once they decide it's going to be a TV show, then they'll actually shoot it for real, and they'll make it better, and you know they'll have saved that money and blah. That's right. Their rationale. But so we do our little live show, and it was flooding in L.A., and you know, Barry Diller didn't show up on the Friday
night.
He was the president. But he didn't announce that he quit until Monday. So the top executive at the network doesn't show up for our thing, the decision maker. So we're sort of kind of thinking we're doomed anyway. And then on Monday, he announces he's going to run the QVC or something. And so it was like, well, okay, everything that was associated with him, we're not going to do because the new guy can't take credit for it because it's left over from the old guy.
So you and I were on a show that just got absolutely thrown in the trash can only because of studio executive stuff that the guy left.
I'm not saying it would have been the genius show that everybody would have loved. It wouldn't have been the next necessarily 2 and a Half Men or Friends or whatever. But it could have been a show, but it couldn't. But it just couldn't live. It had to be murdered. It was like, okay, well, there's a new emperor, so we've got to kill the old emperor's children.
Right.
And so.
Right. But we had fun. We were actually working on that thing, man. You came to my house. We were actually working on scenes. You know, we were working on our characters and everything.
I took my responsibility seriously. And, well, I wanted it to go because I'd already had a few things that didn't go. So at that time, it was like, look, if this doesn't go, it's not going to be my fault.
Right.
I'm going to work hard on it.
And all that week that we were rehearsing and everything, the word was, man, this thing's going, because
Peter Bonners was the director. I didn't realize, even though I had done several of them, I didn't realize what's obvious now is that you have to be performance ready, even at the table read. When you're just sitting at the table reading your script, you want to nail it because there's executives who are watching trying to decide if they should fire you.
Exactly.
And they kind of couldn't fire me because you and I were the main guys, but there was a lot of anxiety that
but they fired a couple girls off it.
Yeah, in retrospect, I feel like Peter Bonners, the director, was kind of shielding me from, but trying to kind of like, let's take it up a notch. And then when it came to the actual presentation, he was like, boy, you really improved. And I was like, yes, well, of course, because we've been rehearsing all week and I've been working on my thing and I've been trying. And so tonight's the night where it's going to be really good. And the rest of the time has been we've been working on it instead of what he knew was, no, you got to try and nail it every night or they'll fire you right now.
Yeah.
And there'll be a new Jake in here tomorrow. I didn't realize that at the time.
A lot of actors don't, who've seen Dustin Hoffman as the actor in Tootsie, and they really think that they can stop everything and go, well, really, I don't think my character would do that. Listen, the only person that can say that is Matt Damon, okay? Everybody else has to just walk into the supermarket and buy the watermelon because it's in the script. Don't say, like, would he really run into the market? I'll tell you what, Ted, you're fired, okay? Bob, come up here and go, you know, sure, I'll go buy a watermelon at the supermarket.
I would say that you don't have to necessarily do it the way that they want to, but you have to do it a way that everybody thinks is funny.
Right.
You don't have to do it their way, but if you're not going to do it their way, it better be like, well, hey, when you do it, somebody at the table laughs.
But especially in television, and I don't think it's – I really don't think it's just a mean guy, I want to fire people. I think it's a matter of just we don't have the time.
No, I think it's like if we don't fire him, someone's going to fire me.
That's true.
Like, I've got to fire him or I'm going to get fired because
– Well, it's so fear-based.
Somebody's going to ask me why I didn't fire him.
Yeah.
You know?
Why did Jake do it like that? I don't think that was... Yeah, I agree. He's terrible. Let's fire him. What? Yeah, Jake, what were you thinking? No, I meant his shirt. Oh, yeah, great performance, Jake. Let's change his shirt.
Oh,
whatever.
God.
Anything.
Oh, God. Then it's enough to drive you to talk into a little box in somebody's house on the internet.
But that's also...
No one can fire us from this, Tom.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? But that's true of, you know, all the guys who are doing their podcasts or guys who are on stage. I think it's good that stand-up comics still, to a great degree, have that I beat the system feeling.
Mm.
that started in high school or whenever is I didn't want a guy yelling at me when I'm sitting in a cubicle and I win.
You don't have that, but you do have that terrible, you know, there is that weird aspect of people say mean stuff to you. Like you go work in a comedy club, people have said mean things from the audience. I mean, they're jerks, but
oh, of course.
They say that.
Yeah.
And then you get a real, quote, real job in show business where you're on a TV show, you're in a movie, and people, you see people around you get fired for ridiculous reasons where they don't give someone a chance to even improve. And so it is a kind of a creep, or they just, or, you know, show business is a job where somebody can decide we're going to get somebody new because your hair is parted on the right. And we're really looking for a guy who's got his hair parted on the left. And it's like, well, really? I could just comb my hair differently. No. Don't. You do what you do. We're going to go get somebody with their hair parted on the other side. It's like, so there's that kind of irrational meanness or just thoughtless, hurty things that can happen to you in show business that don't really happen in a real job. I mean, in some ways, it is more of a kind of emotionally challenging, like somebody's going to do something that would, you know, rightfully make you cry. And you just have to go, oh, okay.
Did you, after our experience in Iron Man, which we were great in, that no one will ever see?
Yeah, well, that's right. This is like the
penis thing.
They had
cameras there, which
like,
was a weird thing. They had cameras, like taping it, which I thought was
odd. Did they tape it? I thought it was illegal for them to tape.
I thought it was too. I thought it was too. And I even mentioned it to somebody saying, well, boy, for paying us as little as you are, you kind of do have cameras here, like taping it like a show.
I blocked that out.
You know who might have it? Mark Hamill. Mark, have you ever met Mark?
No. You mean the Star Wars guy?
Yeah, Mark Hamill, who's a wonderful actor, great guy.
Terrific. I'm sorry that I refer to him as the Star Wars guy.
He
hates that, but I mean, that's my only frame of reference to instantly. That's who we're talking about.
Sure, that is who we're talking about. We did, we worked together on something, and Mark takes Mark is one of those video guys, and he has videos and LaserDisc or whatever of every movie out there. He has a video room in his house, but he takes great pride in if he's working with you, just to needle you a little bit, he will go out and figure out all the bad things you were in, you know, and he's going to screen one of them on one of the days on the set. So he might be able to find some video copy of Iron Man, because I was working with him on something, and he goes, hey, at lunchtime, everybody come to my trailer. Why are we coming to your trailer? Oh, because we're going to screen Tom's pilot of the show Turner and Hooch. You know, the ripoff of that Tom Hanks movie. What? No, Mark.
He had that?
He actually went
out.
How
did he get it?
It's not on my IMDb. It's nowhere. Like, no one would know that I did it, I don't think. But he gets out there and says, what kind of thing did Tom do? Oh, he was in the TV pilot of Turner and Hooch, and did that ever air or whatever?
How does he get the
I have no idea. He just has friends at studios or something, so he gets some
old... I'm scared to even see it. I want to see it, but I will... I would only pursue that if I could be guaranteed that you and I would watch it together and then...
Oh, and I'll just cry. But then, you know, Visitors and Fish right after.
Oh, that is bad, because I have a copy of that.
You do?
And I can't watch it.
Did it air ever?
That was like a double whammy. So, Brandon Tartikoff, the writers were friends with Brandon Tartikoff, and he had made this deal because it was based on a personal story of one of the writers. They then got me on board, and it became this thing, and then they shot it, and the casting process was painful and bizarre, and I was on board early, so I got to witness it, but I didn't even realize what I was seeing. You know, I'm reading with the other people who are potentially going to
be they might be your girlfriend or your
on the show
person or whatever.
And so, you know, you kind of think they're good, and you get attached to them, but you have no say in who's going to get hired at all. So you're just watching and hoping that someone else, like, I think this guy is good, don't you?
Yeah.
And, you know, no. They don't.
In my experience, it's almost always as a new person.
The guy that they hired was great, but there were other great guys who auditioned who didn't get hired for whatever. And anyway, so Brandon Tartikoff, he was in love with it, but then he fell out of love with it, and then the writer's strike. They had decided that it wasn't going to go. I'm sorry, the show's not going to go. Maybe it'll be a mid-season replacement. That's how they kind of wind you out of, like, it's a no, but while you're walking to your car, don't poop in the mailbox because it might be a mid-season replay. You know, they kind of consolation prize you that. And so you have your hopes up for that, and it's like, well, no, we know it's going to be mid-season now. It's not going to be that. And then the writer's strike happened, and then it was like they're airing everything that they've got. And I get a phone call then finally from the producer, the writer-producers, who say, the show is going to be on TV. They're not picking it up, but they're actually going to air the pilot on NBC because of the writer's strike. They're out of stuff to air, and so they're going to air it in 6 weeks on NBC. And then the writer's strike ended, and they called up and said, you know what? Now they're back in production on the other stuff. They're not going to air the show. So there was a moment when it was maybe going to be on TV, but it never
aired. But you got a VHS that you have now.
I have it somewhere on VHS, yeah.
Mark Hamill right now is in your video
library.
He could
go get it. He doesn't really care about me. That's the thing. Right now I'm under Mark Hamill's radar. Not anymore, thanks to us talking into this tiny box. But
well, thanks. Thanks so much for talking with me into the tiny box. I could go, you know, forever with this.
Maybe this will be a three-parter. I could be a regular guest on your show. Maybe that's a way that I could be useful. What I'll do is I'll just come back and do a little five-minute. We'll have a little five-minute talk every once in a while. We don't need to have a big, giant talk. I feel like this was – I hope people have enjoyed it. It was fun. I feel like, you know, people will listen to it and they'll say what they thought. I think it's good that we're wrapping up. There were times when I forgot that we were talking into the little tiny machine and – I hope people listen to it. I hope they enjoy it. And then I hope we get to do it again sometime. And, you know, just, am I enough?
Thanks for being here. Oh, well, I'm at your house. Thanks for being in your own house, okay. Jake. Well, as you can hear, I hope it came through on the podcast. Jake Johansson is one of my favorite guys, one of my best buddies. We've known each other for a long time, and it's always great to talk to him. And I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Thanks so much to Emily Wilson for producing, and thanks to Chris and Katie, everybody at Nerdist. Thanks to McPherson Guitars, Dean Markley Strings for helping me out with the guitar and strings and fabulous things for my live show. And thanks to you, as always. Thanks to Jake, of course. Thanks to Jake Johansson for his time and his guest house, but thanks to you. And hey, consider subscribing or telling a friend about it. I always appreciate your feedback, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.